I'm going to now introduce somebody whose organization needs no introduction, the World Economic Forum. Dominic Wargrey is head of public-private partnerships and is a member of the executive committee, and we're very lucky to have Dominic here to give the keynote today. Dominic, we'd love to look forward to your words.
Thank you, Andrew.
Please join us.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I've been asked a little bit this morning to talk about issues to do with environmental risk and what it means for the global economy. So not a small topic, but we'll try and make it kind of short and snappy and hopefully fairly interesting and entertaining for you. So I'm very honored to speak with you today and to thank our hosts who have been referenced already. We're at the World Economic Forum, as you know, an international organization for public-private cooperation. So in that regard, we cover many kind of global public good issues, trade, jobs gap, infrastructure financing. I and my colleagues look after, if you like, the environmental angle, and that's what I will talk to you a little bit about today. So one of my tasks is to try and place the issue of environmental and natural resource risks in the context of the broader economy, because I sense that often we look at these really at a project level, and I want to try and kind of take us a little bit further up and look at this at a systemic level. So that's the kind of the playing field, if you like, for the conversation. Hopefully it'll set a bit of a scene for your discussions as we move on. So this is a good test of your eyes at this time of the morning, but trust me, like any good graph, it's the top right hand side of the matrix where the action is. The top right-hand side of this matrix relates to our Global Risk Report for 2016. You might have heard about this Global Risk Report. Every year, we survey close to 1,000 risk professionals, not just environmental, all sorts of people, to say kind of what's on your mind in terms of the biggest impact risk and the most likely thing that's going to occur within the next 10 years, i.e. what are the problems out there that you see? So go top right. And if your eyes are good enough, you'll see that I put a little red circle around that, because top right, we have this very interesting kind of interconnection. You can see a failure to deal with, adapt to, or mitigate climate change, water crises, and involuntary migration. Pretty interesting. The most impactful risk over the next 10 years and the most likely risk over the next 10 years. Now, you are pretty educated folks. You can immediately see the interconnectivity there, and that's the kind of systemic point. You can start to see that storyline about involuntary migration, water crises, failure to adapt to climate change, which pervades today our political economy, let alone our structural economic issues of tomorrow. So if we go a little bit further down that line, this hopefully you can read a little bit better because the writing's a little bit larger for you, but let's put these in terms of the top four ranked in terms of perceived likelihood on the left and in terms of perceived impact on the right. That interconnectivity starts to emerge a little bit better, right? Weapons of mass destruction aside, in terms of impact, you can see that we have this basket of large-scale involuntary migration, very likely. Extreme weather events, very likely. Failure to mitigate and adapt to climate change, very likely. Interstate conflict. High-impact failure of climate change, high-impact water crises, high-impact large-scale involuntary migration. These are not environmental professionals who did this. These are people who kind of look across the risk factors of the world economy. Some of you and some of your colleagues may have been part of that study, but others too. If we cut it by time horizons, next 18 months, next 10 years. This starts to unpack for us, I think, as kind of professionals in this space, the difficulty of politics and immediacy versus long-term structural risks. So you see the next 18 months. What are the big, most impactful risks in the next 18 months to deal with? The migration issue, state collapse, interstate conflict, unemployment, underemployment, failure of national governance. Again, you don't need to be a kind of a sort of political scientist to join those dots and turn that into a political narrative that we're seeing playing out, particularly in Europe at the moment. However, for the next 10 years, slightly different take. Water crises, failure to adapt to climate change, extreme weather events, you get the point. is that those who kind of look at structural risks to the global economy know that we have some big issues, some structural issues to deal with in the long run, but the noise in the short run, the political noise in the short run, kind of means it's really hard to deal with the drivers of what's creating the short-run problem. So it takes us to a very, very important part of the subject, which is perhaps what you are trying to deal with in this work, which is trying to course correct for those structural risks in our economic planning. So pretty interesting, we think. Finally, like anything in life, it's got to play out somewhere. And you'll see here's a sort of map with, you know, how this plays out. Now, classically, in the Middle East, North Africa, you can see this constellation of water crises, under unemployment, failure in government, political, social instability. A pretty clear story when people start to tell a narrative of what's going on in Syria and such. But also pick out where we are in water and weather risks in South Asia and extreme weather events in the US. This is the first time that risk professionals are starting to identify weather risk in the US. Usually it's been things to do with cybersecurity or issues like that. So this is starting to come home to roost. So the thesis here from that first sketch, which is our global risk report, non-environmental professionals providing that analysis, read by decision makers around the world, one of our top three most referenced reports, is that we want to look at environment and natural resource risks as systemic challenges facing the global economy, as structural problems facing the global economy, and not necessarily an ESG or a small project-related risk. These are big-ticket items. Let me try and kind of drill into that a little bit further to put some flesh on the bones. Don't know if anybody recognizes that. It's not a geography lecture, but who has been to Niagara Falls here, Niagara Falls between the US and Canada? That's pretty good. That's a good result. Those of you who haven't been, you can see the image in your head, right, from films and such of the Niagara Falls, people going over it in a barrel and this kind of thing, Superman and all that. Niagara Falls, you took that photo probably where you were standing about here with you and your loved one or on holiday or something. The US Geological Survey estimates that to produce and burn, the US burns about 900 million tons, imperial tons of coal a year, so just shy of a billion tons of coal a year to produce about 35% of its energy mix. The US Geological Survey estimates that to produce and generate electricity from that coal takes between 250 and 340 trillion litres of water a year. Now, that's quite a big number. My, you know, car, I should be electric, but it isn't yet, takes about 40 litres of water. So I can't get my head around 340 trillion litres of water a year. But go back to Niagara Falls. And remember when you had that photo, when you were there, don't stand there for an hour, don't stand there for a day, don't stand there for a week or 2 weeks or 1 month, but stand there for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 5 months solid, and all the water that goes out of Niagara Falls in that period is about that 340 trillion litres of water that the US economy needs to generate electricity for about 35% of its energy mix from coal. Quite a lot of water, particularly when you start to kind of map where water scarcity is and where energy plants are or where they will be, or indeed where water scarcity will get worse under even the most conservative IPCC scenarios. Starts to get a bit risky and starts to get a bit structural for the US economy, according to the US Geological Survey. In fact, when the Department of Energy got hold of this, they identified that 26% of US power plant design capacity, particularly coal, is in areas of medium high, high, or extremely high baseline water stress. That's the energy that's serving about 40% of the US economy. And by 2025, which is this graph, you can add seven more states to that. You put about a further 9% of US GDP at risk, or close to about 50% of US GDP, which is being served by power plants, fossil fuel-driven power plants, particularly coal, which are going to be facing high levels of water stress. So systemically, I want to sort of posit to you that these environmental natural resource risks are not necessarily just project-related. They actually permeate across the whole of the economy. But you might be thinking, that's okay, because we fund unconventional gas. That's all right. Well, the bad news is it's not. From this particular perspective, this is Mindy Luber's outfit, Ceres, which is an investor network in the US, and they rather handily mapped where the unconventional gas wells are, overlain by water scarcity. And the result, basically, was that about half of all of the unconventional gas fracking wells are in areas of extreme water scarcity. And it takes, as you well know, probably from your own risk analysis at a project level, quite a lot of water to frack gas. So, from a US perspective, and I haven't mentioned, by the way, the word climate change at all in that analysis. So from a US perspective, this is pretty interesting because what are we looking at here? We're looking at perhaps the 20th century was an energy policy dominated perhaps by, you know, cheap, affordable energy. The 21st century might be an energy policy dominated by natural resource risk, water security. I don't need to tell you about the kind of droughts that the West and the Southwest are facing, or where most people are moving to in the US. But of course, it's not just a US problem. If you look across Asia, areas of water scarcity and where power plants are, and then you transfer like the suggested IPCC scenarios of water stress. The red is stress. It's kind of psychological, isn't it? But red is stress, and it looks a lot worse. India, in particular, is an interesting case. We are delighted across the global community, and Eric mentioned this about the Paris Agreement and such, that India has committed to ratify the Paris Agreement, which is a big deal, with the European Commission behind it as well. We'll soon get close to that becoming into force. But India has 240 million people without access to electricity, mostly in rural areas, rightly seeks to move them out of poverty. It's made its plan for Paris, which is 40% of non-fossil fuels in its energy mix by 2030, but it also plans to expand its coal capacity. In fact, it plans for 400 gigawatts of coal by 2035. That's a 40% plus increase in its energy mix of coal, which, if you're looking at this from a climate and greenhouse gas emissions lens, will equate to about 5 gigatons of emissions by 2030, or about as much as the US emits today. So our climate friends kind of push on India on this direction. India pushes back, saying, but we need the right to develop, which is very fair. However, that is not the key natural resource risk, I would posit to you, because the coal that India needs to build has to be the cheapest coal. And the cheapest coal is also the thirstiest coal. It's subcritical coal-fired power stations, which need close to 2,000 litres per megawatt hour. So you remember Niagara Falls in the US? That's pretty smart, water-efficient coal-fired power stations that the US have. To build cheap coal in India is going to require a lot of extra water. In fact, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, estimate up to 60 billion cubic meters of water a year by 2035. Now, again, 60 billion cubic liters of water a year, it's difficult for me to gauge that. That's what this picture helps us to do. This is a water tanker. It will be a water tanker. At the moment, you can see it's an oil tanker. Oil tankers generally, like this one, hold about 34 meters cubed of liquid. Get rid of oil and write water on that tanker, because the water that India will need for all of those coal-fired power stations, which are subcritical, to have 400 gigawatts by 2035, the water that it will need will translate into one of those tankers for every man, woman, and child in the Indian population by 2035, assuming 1.6 billion people in India. It's about 1.3 something at the moment. So if you're an Indian farmer and you're facing water issues and your government is planning an expansion in the energy sector, and one of those trucks, which could have been your water, is going for about 40% of India's fuel driven by coal, you can start to see the political risk, as well as the environmental risk, and as well as just the sort of project-related risk when you start looking at, you know, how viable each of these plants are. It's something that when people are engaging with investors and colleagues and developers in India, we usually go on the climate ticket about this issue of coal in India. We very rarely go on the water ticket. And I would posit to you that the work that you are doing around kind of natural resource risk and the screening tools that were played up earlier can provide such a huge benefit to the agenda, not just at project appraisal level, but also at this broader engagement of key developing and emerging economies like India as to the energy future that it seeks to invest in and create. That water, which I mentioned, about 60 billion cubic meters a year, is about 12% of the Ganges' average historical annual flow. Now, anybody who knows kind of India, and I'm sure you do very well, you know, the rivers in India don't flow the same amount all year round. It's monsoon driven. So for a very short period of time, there's lots of water. Rest of the time, there's not much. A power station needs its water all the time. Doesn't work on a monsoon basis. So again, the challenge here is also going to be intermittent because there isn't the kind of storage capacity that will be required. Overall, that demand will push the demand for water for energy in India up from 2 to 8% as a share of national withdrawals. So who's going to lose out from that when already 90% of the water is being used for agriculture, even more in some states? How's that going to work as you seek to grow your industrial sector as well? It's a real-time systems problem for India. Right now, 91 reservoirs are an average of 29% of storage capacity, according to the Central Water Commission. We're sort of getting into summertime a little bit now in India. And just a few months ago, the flagship 2,300-megawatt coal plant at a place called Faraka Town in West Bengal had to suspend its generation, no water. So it's already starting to happen. This is not sort of, you know, modelling. This is kind of real for a key emerging economy which we seek to generate growth to fuel the world as China starts to slow and Africa is yet to have the infrastructure to take off. So it's a systems level challenge. Tell me, who is going to be working with the power sector in India or indeed in the US or indeed in Indonesia to take a kind of hydrological basin-wide context into risk modeling in terms of those investments over a 20, 30, 40-year period? Should it be the World Bank? Well, maybe it should be, but if you know the World Bank, did we have a colleague here from the World Bank, by the way? Right, so if you know the World Bank, you know, we are so vertically aligned in our department. Here's an energy department, here's a water group, here's, you know, an infrastructure group. There's hardly any horizontal interplay that goes across. Arguably, it's the same in most governments. Here's a water ministry. Here's an energy ministry. Here's an agricultural ministry. Arguably, you might suggest, Eric, it's kind of the same in the international community as well. It's really hard to do what you guys are doing, which is draw a horizontal integrated line across these systemic problems and provide kind of screening tools. It's so, so important. Not just at a project level, but at a structural, systemic level. I had another slide here, which was about the Arctic. I want to touch upon this, but then it just dawned on me there was something else I could slip in here. So basically, we know from all the newspapers that you read that the Arctic is melting horribly quickly, much more quickly than the modelers would have suggested. In fact, it's where it was in 2012 compared to 1980. That's supposed to be 2060, but it's already arrived. And we know the kinds of issues that it's creating at a local level. But one of the interesting structural economic problems of this melt is what the scientists call teleconnections. So less ice means less white, means more dark, means more absorption of energy in the sea and in the air, which means a real disturbance into the kind of circulatory system that the world has. The Arctic is the only ocean which touches all the other oceans at the top of the world, so it kind of runs like a conveyor belt around. If that starts to get perturbed, it runs a warm, not a cold, conveyor belt around, which affects the water and it affects the air. That's the Gulf Stream and the jet stream. Remember India? Not only is this snowmageddon in Boston, it's also changing monsoon patterns in India. If India's building coal and needs the water and the monsoon patterns are changing, Arctic becomes India's problem as much as anybody else's, not just Norway's problem, or Russia's problem, or Canada's problem. These structural, environmental, natural resource risks start to glue together into a kind of systemic challenge. So any kind of appraisal or screening about the kind of natural capital thing, I would urge, has to get kind of to a systemic as well as a project level. And we are very far away from being able to do that in terms of breaking through to mainstream thinking. But we are there, I think, in terms of some other intellectual thinking. The other one I wanted to draw a little bit of attention to while we're kind of scooting through this, which I didn't have a slide for, but it suddenly struck me on the flight over, was the Thai floods of 2011-2012. The floods in Thailand in 2011 were caused greatly not only to do with climate change, but also to do with the fact there'd been lots of deforestation, a sort of landscape had changed, and so when the water did come, it kind of flooded towns and industrial sectors quite heavily. 65 of 77 provinces were flooded in 2011-2012 in Thailand, knocked about 1% of GDP of Thailand, but it became, according to the World Bank, the fourth most costly it's not really environmental, but sort of natural disaster, they call it, kind of a catastrophe after Fukushima, Kobe, and Katrina. How did that happen? Well, it happened because Thailand, where the water flooded and hit, was in the north of the country where all its industrial manufacturing base is. Thailand makes 25% of the world's hard drives. Honda, Toyota, Hitachi all have their kind of factories up there. These all got knocked out. And so when people started to add up the costs of this, it became economically a hugely impactful, the fourth biggest, most economically costly economic natural resource disaster. 30% of global rice is traded out of Thailand. That got hit. So again, these natural resource risks, they might kind of be locationally specific. You might think of them as a project screening, but actually in our interconnected world, this radiates out quite quickly. It's a systemic challenge. So ideas? You know, what is to be done? I would commend massively the work that you are undertaking here with the projects that you've referenced. We absolutely need this work. However, there are probably a couple of extra things that one might suggest, if you don't mind me saying. One is to think about the new technologies that we have in play. You probably, being in sort of the financial world, know all about blockchain and the impact it's having in the financial sector. But there's a pretty interesting thing about some of these crypto technologies and how they can help in terms of thinking through natural resource management, which you might be starting to get into. But if you have a screening tool that's pretty good at a project level and can identify and make clear kind of what the risk is, what's the implementing tool? And the implementing tool might not be an institution in the old sense of the world, but might be a kind of fairly incorruptible, transparent piece of technology where everybody's allocated the right to that resource base and is able to trade it based on a kind of science-related target, which you can do in real time, probably on a 3G, 4G phone. That water issue in India that I talked about, imagine with the screening that you have in place from this product, related to the investment criteria for the Ministry of Energy and the Ministry of Ag, but in a specific location, key states, where actually the right to water on a science-based application is allocated through a blockchain technology to different stakeholders, such that the poorest women-headed household in, Maharashtra could trade with the power company for that water. The ability to spread wealth around those resources becomes huge. So it's not just a regulatory tool to stop, it's also a positive social policy to create opportunity and wealth. So the application of these kind of emergent technologies to deliver against the screening that you might be creating, I think, can be very, very profound indeed. The other kind of big trend that I would say that is occurring is around the systems leadership. And I touched upon it earlier with the work that you guys are doing with these tools. If you think about it, if we go back to that US or the India example, or indeed the kind of global issues around, you know, flood-related risk in supply chains or the Arctic, you're going to need people like yourselves, people who can look at something from one institutional perspective, but can also stand and say, well, let me look at this from the Indian government's perspective, or let me look at it from the World Bank's perspective, or let me try and pick out the best task team that we can find across these different organizations and really kind of work, if you like, that intervention, time to goal over the next 3 or 4 years and make this happen. This idea of kind of horizontal projects across the different verticals that we have in our economy, the financial system, our intergovernmental system, our best think tanks, our best universities, is becoming kind of an emergent trend. And I would encourage, perhaps as one last thought, that when you start to turn the tools into a sort of engagement, as you mentioned in the presentation, but also an implementation advice, you don't kind of host this in one organization, but you try to create a network that cuts across these organizations to deliver it. We can see it in things in the soft commodity space, like the Tropical Forest Alliance, which some of you might have heard of, or in the Water Resources Group, which some of you might have heard of, and in other areas besides. And I would suggest that the institutional delivery mechanism will be as important as the tool that you create in our networked world, as important as perhaps the kind of technological basis on which you provide it, if we're going to get systemic to tackle these problems, rather than just be very, very project orientated. Because we have to go wholesale and deal with the system and not just stay retail and deal with the project if we're seriously going to tackle the challenges that we seem to be facing. Thank you.